I am Elle Penelope, author of epic fantasy and paranormal romance, and welcome to My Imaginary Friends, a look behind the scenes of an author mapping the worlds in my head and making them a reality. Hello, friends. Today is Sunday, October 18th, 2020, and this is episode 90 of My Imaginary Friends. I'm Leslie. So this week's best thing is that Song of Blood and Stone, my first book and the first book in the Earthsinger Chronicles, was listed as one of Time Magazine's best fantasy books of all time. Now, this list came out this past Thursday. So what's interesting is that I was on the computer, I was working, and I am part of a Slack group, and I saw the list mentioned on the Slack group, and some of the other people in the group were on it, and I was like, oh, that list came out. I clicked on it. I didn't look at it. I was pretty busy, and I minimized it so that I could read it later, and then I was planning on going and seeing who I knew on it and congratulating them and all of that, and it did not cross my mind that I would be on this list. So hours later, in the middle of my day, I'm on a work phone call, and I see my email notification pop up, and it's my publicist, and I see the beginning of the subject line, and so I'm trying to have this, you know, reasonable, measured work conversation when I see this email pop up, which is one reason why maybe you should not have notifications on. I do have notifications on my computer. Anyway, yeah, so I managed to finish the conversation, and then I look at the email, and then I look at the list. And so that is how I found out. So the first thing I do is I text my mom and my brother, I make a screenshot, and then I text my closest friends and my husband and my brother-in-law, sister-in-law, father-in-law, and I'll rely on them to tell everybody else. And I'm not exactly sure how to feel. It's like when things happen that are really crazy and unexpected, I sort of freeze and my emotions kind of freeze. My brother calls me a little while later and he's like so psyched and he's just like geeking out and he's like, Are you excited? And I'm like, oh yes, I am. I'm just having a problem processing and having that come out of me. You know, I feel stunted in some way. Like, did this really happen? Yeah, and in some ways, I still feel like that. Like, I still feel, wow, how did that happen? You know. So in the article on how they chose the 100 best fantasy books of all time, they talk about developing, you know, the list of people, the panel of leading fantasy authors who helped decide. And so they include Cassandra Clare, Diana Gabaldon, Neil Gaiman, N.K. Jemisin, George R.R. Martin, Marlon James, Saba Tahir. And I'm like, so do these people know about my book? I know that N.K. Jemisin knows about my book because I was on a panel with her and I gave her a bookmark. And she was sort of, she hadn't heard of the book before and she was kind of chastising herself. And I was like, well, because she likes to keep up with, you know, the black fantasy books and authors. I was just like, oh no, well, you know, we had submitted to you to do a blurb, but you were writing for the New York Times at the time and weren't doing any blurbs, at the time because it would have been a conflict of interest. So I was like, oh, here's a bookmark. And I was sitting next to her signing books. And so I had had a lovely conversation with her during that event. It was for the Brooklyn Book Festival, I guess, last year, the year before. When was that? Time has no meaning right now, right? But, like, does Neil Gaiman know about my book? Does Diana Gabaldon know about? You know, so you're kind of thinking, like, how did this happen? Now, granted, I was on Time Magazine's radar because they listed my book as one of the top 10 fantasy books of 2018. Same book, Song of Blood and Stone. But even given that, like when I saw the list come out, I was like, oh, of all time. Well, that's obviously, it's not going to include my book. The panel of authors created a nomination, created a list of nominees, 250 nominees, and then they rated them. And then the editors considered the finalists based on key factors. This is a quote, including originality, ambition, artistry, critical and popular reception, and influence on the fantasy genre and literature more broadly. The word ambition kind of popped out at me because only very recently have I realized that I am an ambitious person. I would have told you a couple of years ago that I'm not ambitious. I've never wanted to have like a high position in a company or a leadership position. I didn't want the responsibility. And once I started completely working for myself, that became a non-issue. But it's not like I even wanted to grow my company and have employees. You know, I run a business. I'm a website developer. I subcontract things. So I kind of hire people, but I don't have employees and things like that. And I never wanted to. I've never wanted to grow and be this big thing. And so I always thought that meant I didn't have ambition. But as I am, you know, working on this new project and thinking about the books that I've written, The Rosinger Chronicles specifically, but even something like my other books that are, you know, get less attention, the self-published books, in each of those books, I was trying to do something. And I guess that you could call it ambitious in a way. And having finished the fourth and final Rosinger Chronicles book, I think that book was incredibly ambitious. And I realized that I set myself up at the beginning for that in what I tried to do. So I've recently become more comfortable calling myself that, even though it still feels uncomfortable a little bit, because I don't, you know, you think of ambition as sort of ruthlessness a lot of times, but when I say it, I mean, I'm trying to do something big, you know, like many podcasts ago, I talked about trying to make an impact with my work. And I feel like I really am thinking about that all the time, you know, in all the stories that I'm writing. And that in and of itself is an ambitious thing to even have a goal of, you know. So I will own that somewhat reluctantly, but trying to be more comfortable with even saying and thinking it. And looking at those criteria and thinking about the other books on the list, and it's still mind-blowing. That's the only thing I can say. Like I do feel like my emotions are just like, they just froze in place, didn't know what to do, and haven't really unfrozen yet. So yes, that is this week's best thing. It's interesting that, you know, I look at the other people on the list, and a lot of the modern ones, the ones that I'm familiar with, are people who have been nominated or won, you know, awards like the Nebula and the Hugo and things like that. And one of my friends, I'm talking to you, Denny, was always like, "Oh, Leslie, you're writing literary." And I'm like, I don't write literary fantasy. That's, I don't have any desire to. And I don't think that's what I write. And when people have made comparisons to N.K. Jemisin, and I think that's just because women in SFF, but I think that she is definitely extremely ambitious with what she's trying to do. And I personally don't consider my work like hers in any real meaningful way. But I think about the first draft of Song of Blood and Stone, and, you know, I pantsed that. I tell that story a lot. I completely pantsed the story, and I had this vision of this girl on the shotgun and this guy who'd been captured, and he was, you know, wasn't beaten down internally. And it took me 2 days to write that draft. At the end of the second day, the refugee showed up in the story. And I don't know. I didn't expect for that to happen. That's one of the wonderful things about discovery writing. Like, I discovered that there were these refugees, and they have been there since the very first draft, even though it wasn't completely thought out in terms of the way that the book is today. So from the very beginning, I thought I was just writing a love story, just a star-crossed love story, but something inside of me had added a refugee crisis and a country that didn't want these refugees and eventually wanted to send them back. And so when I was originally writing that, it was 2013, and it was the Syrian refugee crisis in the news. And I think that was what I was sort of responding to. The more things change, the more they stay the same. And I'm finding that more and more as I research the 1920s for my new story, the new book that I'm working on, and, you know, reading articles and newspapers and just researching the people and the time period, and the more things change, the more they stay the same. It is so interesting to see newspaper articles complaining about, you know, one that comes to mind that I read just the other day was a front page of the Washington, the Evening Star, which was not even one of the black newspapers. It was one of the white newspapers talking about, you know, this, I forget which state it was. There was a lynching, another lynching, and the authorities had no plans to do anything about it. And that was like the headline, no plans to make any arrests in this latest lynching. I think it might've been in Missouri or something. And today, you know, no plans to make any arrests when police murder black people and unarmed black people. It's, there's a lot of parallels. One interesting bit of research that I think I'm going to post on Instagram. I'm setting my story in 1925, the new book, The Heist Story, in DC. And one of the reasons is because in August, there was a very large Klan march down Pennsylvania Avenue. I think it ended up being 20 to 30,000 Klan members. And this was at the height of the Klan in the 20th century. And an article on the day after the march, the headline was, "Pickpocket mobs fleece Klansmen. One arrest follows many reports of operations by crooks." And it says some of the cleverest pickpocket mobs, in quotes, from the Metropolitan District of New York City are believed by the police to have descended upon Washington with plans for widespread fleecing of visitors and participants in the crowded Klan celebration today. And then I told my friends, and they were like, were these white pickpockets or black pickpockets? And I was like, if they were black, they would have said colored. So apparently they were white people who decided there was a big opportunity to rob the Klan during this march. So I thought that was an interesting historical tidbit. Research is revealing all kinds of interesting things like that, which is super fun. And also very sad and difficult. But, you know, looking at what my parents and grandparents and great-grandparents all the way back had to go through, and then what people today are still going through, it's just really interesting. It's kind of like, how could I not have these things to say? Like, all of this is bubbling up inside of me. And I believe that there's ancestral memory. I believe that there's, I don't know, you know, we do stand on the shoulders of the people who came before us. And for some reason, I've been called since I was a very small child to write. I've always written. I always have written and wanted to write. And at different parts of my life, I didn't think it was a reasonable thing to do. I didn't think it was possible for me to have this happen, to have books in bookstores. And then I realized that it was possible. I'm not exactly sure why my emotions are still in this sort of holding pattern, but I think maybe they are starting to thaw as I talk about it, because a lot of me doesn't want to believe things like that happen. And then there's another part. There's always the imposter syndrome where you're like, do I even deserve this? And there has been a little bit, at least things online that I've seen. Like one, there was a tweet that was, I guess, like happy for me, but also kind of started out by saying, well, these lists are always exclusionary. And then, you know, I saw another tweet that was like, well, these lists can't be comprehensive. And I'm like, it's a list of 100. So yes, it's not comprehensive. It's not every book. And I guess it's exclusionary because there are 100 books on the list. So those are true things. Are those things that needed to be said? I don't know. Because, you know, when I first saw the list and immediately knew that there was no way that I would be on it, there's happiness for the people who do make it. And because I already knew that, you know, there's certain people that I am acquainted with, you know, have met at various things or books I've read that are on the list. And I'm like, yeah, that's wonderful. You know, you feel happy for them. And you're like, I wish I could have been on it. And it so happened that I did make it. And then, but if I hadn't, I would still have that feeling. So like, I get it, you know, I get anyone's reaction is like, oh, well, that list isn't really, you know, or it's too modern. Like one tweet I saw, that was like, well, it was very old books and very new books and very little in between. And they listed some names of who I guess are popular fantasy authors who actually I've never heard of, but like white men fantasy authors that, you know, were off the list and making, you know, statements about that because the list was extremely diverse, extremely inclusive. which I believe was the point, because the panel that they brought together was a very diverse panel of, you know, leading fantasy authors. I don't know the makeup of the Time editorial board, but I feel like one of the purposes was to create a list and call it the, you know, the best fantasy books of all time, and show the diversity of voices in the fantasy genre. And people, you know, at the top of their game, doing it well, and being original, being ambitious, artistic, along with the critical and popular reception and the influence on the genre and literature. And those are really important things to think about. And, you know, even if I hadn't been on the list, I would have appreciated that for what it is. So I think I'm rambling now, but yeah, I'm kind of still in the process of processing it and trying to get over that voice in my head that's like, do you really deserve to be there? Every author, every artist, I think, feels that imposter syndrome. And I've talked about it before. And I think, you know, if anyone who is honest will talk about it and will say that they don't always feel like they belong in the spaces that they're in. I watched Ocean's 8 yesterday, and this is still relevant. There's a point where Sandra Bullock says, "We're not doing this for us. We're doing it for that 8-year-old little girl lying in bed who has always dreamed of being a criminal. Let's do it for her." So as a way to combat my imposter syndrome, I think of, you know, the little girls and boys out there who want to be writers, who dream of seeing their books on bookshelves, and now they can walk into a bookstore, now or in the future, and see people who look like them on the covers and on the flaps with the author pictures, which is something that I didn't get the opportunity to do very often. And that kind of thing helps my imposter syndrome. You know, a lot of people congratulating me, saying, oh, it's well deserved. And I still have a hard time accepting that, like really accepting and integrating that. I believe that I wrote a good book. I really enjoy reading it all the many, many times that I've had to read it. Interestingly enough, I feel like Whispers of Shadow and Flame, book two, is a better book. Not that it matters at this point, but I think that each book, I believe I got better. And I'm going to get copy edits back on the fourth book, Requiem of Silence. I'm expecting them within the next couple of weeks or maybe month or so. I have actually no idea when they're coming, but my guess is they're coming. They're coming down the pike quickly. I think that's the best book I've written. Now, I haven't read it in a month. I turned it in a month ago. So I could just be delusion, you know, but it's definitely my most ambitious book. I think I got more ambitious with each one, and wrapping up the series that I started in the way that I started it, dealing with the topics that I'm dealing with. Yeah, I will definitely call that one the most ambitious. In other news, in writing, my writing update, I made a breakthrough this week. I'm extremely excited about that. So last week I talked about writing my initial synopsis just to get all my ideas together. I went through that and it revealed quite a bit to me. I figured out a bunch of stuff, and then I was able to look at it and figure out I still have a lot of big holes, but I've got the main structure, the main arc. I know where it begins and where it ends. And so kind of figuring out where it ended allowed me to figure out the things I have to, at least some of them, that I have to build from the beginning. And then I've got this sort of wide open spaces in the middle that I need to figure out what happens. I need to make it more heisty because I've got the bare bones of the actual heist. And I just wanted to have a few more twists and turns and make it a little bit more adventurous and interesting. So I went back to structure this week. I pulled out books. I pulled out my spreadsheet. I am just digging deep into the structure, because once I know the general beginning, middle, and end of it all, then it's about putting it into a story structure that, you know, a good, strong story spine, and brainstorming to fill the holes in. So I started brainstorming all the different locations that I could possibly highlight in this book, in places within the city that I want to show in that time period, characters, real life people that I want to have cameos in the book. And I went back to some of the books I always go back to, Structuring Your Novel by K.M. Wyland, and Screenwriting Tricks for Authors by Alexandra Sokoloff, and then Write Your Novel from the Middle by James Scott Bell. And I was also recommended his book on superstructure, which kind of expands on the Write Your Novel from the Middle. So I was looking at that, going back to my spreadsheet, working it out in the Save the Cat structure method, and also the Dan Wells seven plot point method, which are just tabs in my spreadsheet. I added a new tab for the James Scott Bell superstructure. I have a tab for a sort of a dramatica story structure, and dramatica is a whole thing that I actually don't know that much about. I've read a few blog posts, and I tried to get into it, and it was too much for me. And I am a plot junkie. Dramatica was too much. But this blog post, which is about, I think it's about technically outlining your novel, has some steps that actually helped me a lot. So kind of just running it through these different systems and seeing how it lines up with them, and then where the holes are in the systems, which are basically the same holes everywhere. Just sometimes, you know, you look at it through a slightly different lens. It's called something slightly different in a different system, and it kind of sparks things for me. So that was what this week was about. And I just made some real breakthroughs, which feels really good. I also wrote the log line and like a one paragraph blurb, like back cover copy type of thing, which I think is really helpful to do up front before you've even drafted. So like as an overview, I wrote out the synopsis, which was about maybe 3 or 4 pages of everything that I knew happened in the book. Then I went back and tried to do the 1 to 2 sentence log line, and then expand that into a paragraph for back cover copy, and then go back to the synopsis. And that helped me, you know, kind of going back and forth between those things really helped me focus on some of the things I didn't know yet. And so, yeah, that's kind of where I am now. So it's been a very productive week of writing the new story. I think I might, you know, tweak the synopsis and then share it with a couple of people and get some feedback kind of high level, and continue working on the mechanics and the more details of the outline. I know I don't need to know everything right at the beginning, because I do find things as I write. Like the first draft is doing a first fast draft really helps discover things, just the same way I discovered the refugees when I first wrote Song. But I want to have a handle on more than I have now. It's always more. But I do feel confident that I will be able to start NaNoWriMo. And I might start early. Like, I don't want to wait arbitrarily for Nano. When I feel in the next week, 7 to 10 days, I would guess, I probably will feel comfortable enough to start the fast draft. So I might pregame my Nano, but still try to get 50,000 words in the month of November. If I need that many, the first draft might only be 50,000 words, because my sense is that this book is going to be, I think I'm going to target like 80 to 90,000. Whereas Song, Ursinger Chronicles books, the first three are all 130,000 words. The last one, I think, is almost 150,000 words. So this will be a short book if it's 80 to 90,000 words. But it's not, quote unquote, epic fantasy. It's something else, you know, it's historical fantasy, historical romantic fantasy. I don't know. I think that's what you'd call it. Our featured podcast this month is Tea and Strumpets, and here's a word from them.
Hi, I'm Zoe.
And I'm Kelsey.
And we're the hosts of Tea and Strumpets, a Regency romance review.
Join us each week as we take a trip across the pond and into the past in search of swoon-worthy happily ever afters.
We talk about all your Regency favorites like Julia Quinn's Bridgertons or Lisa Kleypas's Ravenels. Plus, we dive deep into exciting new releases from rising stars like Scarlett Peckham, Kat Sebastian, or Evie Dunmore.
We've got book reviews and fabulous interviews with best-selling authors in the genre like Kerrigan Byrne and Maya Rodale. So check us out on your podcatcher of choice or learn more about us at romancepod.com. See you on Thursdays, and may all your ever afters end happily.
In recommendations, we started watching The Good Lord Bird on Showtime. This is the limited series about John Brown and the raid on Harper's Ferry. And we watched the first two episodes, and they're fantastic. Normally, I'm completely over slave stuff. I couldn't watch Underground. My husband and I, we watched the first episode. We were both like, we can't do this right now. We're just not in the right mindset. I was feeling that way about Lovecraft Country, even though it's the 50s. So I stopped watching it. My husband went back and started again, and I kind of watched some of them over his shoulder. And so I missed a few, but then he kind of caught me up. And so I ended up watching the last few, and then the finale is actually tonight. It's still very uneven for me, but I do appreciate it. I was always glad that it exists. I don't know if I enjoy it, but I think that I'm glad that it's in the world, and I think it has something interesting to say. The Good Lord Bird, I actually actively enjoy, even though it's a slavery story, probably because John Brown is killing a lot of slave masters, quite honestly. And it's very cathartic. And it's funny. It's a dark comedy, but it's also very moving and touching. That second episode, I was just like hooked, because it's also really good writing and storytelling and acting. And you're like, how is this child going to get out of this? Because it's told from the perspective of a young slave boy who John Brown thinks is a girl, and John Brown is completely out of his mind, insane. It's a very good show. I recommend it. I highly, highly recommend it. I've also been continuing in my heist research. Like I said, I watched Ocean's 8. I had rewatched Ocean's 11. We watched Entrapment last night, which was not actually a heist story. I would consider that film more of just about thieves. It's with Sean Connery and Catherine Zeta-Jones. So some things get lumped into heist, but I think heist is specific. And some things are just cons, and some other things are just about thievery. Entrapment was interesting. I did get Rififi from the library, which is a French film from the 1950s that shows up on all the lists of best heist movies, but it's not streamable anywhere. And I was like, well, how am I going to get this movie? There's no video stores anymore. And then I remembered that the library can give you movies. And I'd actually checked out Sweet Charity months ago for another book. When I was writing Ella, when I was going back for Song of Blood and Stone, if you've read the special edition, I had to add a storyline, and I added Ella's character. And so Sweet Charity was part of my research for that, because I wanted just to soak up what an eternal optimist would be like. Sidebar. So yes, I rented this movie from the library, and I'm going to watch it at some point. And the research continues. I was recommended some more things by some more people. So my media research on heists will continue as I'm working on this story. So I think that's it for me for this week. And thanks so much for coming along with me on this journey. And I will talk to you next week. For episode show notes and to sign up for the Footnotes newsletter and get the show notes in your inbox, go to myimaginaryfriendsshow.com. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and check out the video episodes on YouTube. I would really appreciate a rating or review to help support the show. And My Imaginary Friends is part of the Frolic Podcast Network. For more fantastic podcasts, go to frolic.media/podcasts.